The hour 10:15 having arrived, we will call the House Tax Committee to order. We will do some housekeeping tasks here when we actually have a quorum. We will get started, even though we're short a few members. We want to, you know, life belongs to those that show up, I figure, so let's get to work here. Representative Downey will be moving House File 1823, and there are some amendments, but until we have a quorum, we won't act on anything. But what will be happening is Representative Downey will be moving House File 1823 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So with that being said, Representative Downey, if you could please start your presentation. And again, once we have a quorum, we will move some amendments and minutes and things like that. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. The bill before you has two kind of key components to it, and the first is a minor enhancement and change to the angel investment tax credit that we passed 2 years ago. And then the second portion of it is something that many of us here in committee have heard before, and that's the small business investment company credit program. And if I could, Mr. Chair, I think it's probably easiest to deal with the bill, even though the sections are kind of intermingled within the language of the bill. I think it's easiest and best for us to deal with the angel investment eligibility changes and some of the provisions that we're recommending to that program first, and then we can get to the small business investment company credit after that and keep those two segregated. So if I could just briefly introduce the angel investment credit portion of the bill and the changes in the program that we're recommending. And then I know Mr. Nelson from Deed is here, and I believe there's a testifier who wants to explain some of their perspectives on these things too. So the angel program, as many know, was passed last year or 2 years ago. It's now been in effect for, I guess, maybe 1.5 years, and we're starting to get some data back on the impacts of that program. There were a few things that we picked up on as the department started working companies and investment firms through their eligibility criteria. A couple places where it might be possible for business owners or investors looking to get into the credit program to game the system a little bit. I don't know if that's probably an overly strong term, but there's some criteria that we think should be adjusted to make sure that the program is being fairly administered, and then a couple of other things with it. And with that, Mr. Chairman, and I think it'd probably be most beneficial to the members to hear from Mr. Nelson and Mr. Alexander.
Thank you, Representative Downey. If Mr. Nelson and Mr. Alexander could please join Representative Downey. Okay, whoever would like to start, if you state your name and who you represent for the record, please. I think we'll start with Mr. Nelson from Deed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Nelson. I'm the Angel Tax Coordinator for the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. What I wanted to do is to spend a few moments reviewing what the program is and how it works, and then I wanted to give you an update on some of the accomplishments that the program's made in the last 2 years. As you know, the Angel Tax Credit Program is a 25% tax credit for investors who invest in small, emerging, primarily high-tech businesses in Minnesota. The purpose, of course, is to encourage the growth and foster job creation in Minnesota by these businesses. There's three parties that benefit: the businesses that are gaining the capital that they need to grow, the investors who by using the credit have a lower risk in these very high-risk new businesses, and Minnesota in general by growing new businesses, creating new jobs. It is a 25% tax credit. One of the key features of the program is that it is a refundable credit, meaning that if your tax, your Minnesota tax is insufficient, you will get a refund from the Department of Revenue. What that does is not only encourage taxpayers to really invest in this program, but also for those taxpayers who do not have any Minnesota tax liability, such as people from outside of Minnesota or even outside of the country, they can participate in this program, importing their capital into Minnesota. There are some maximums: $125,000 in tax credits per year per individual, and $250,000 if you're married filing jointly. We have a number of program limits. This year, we have $12 million in credits maximum that we can provide. In terms of investors, investors must be a natural person. I often have explained that to John next to here, that if I pinch you hard enough and you bleed, you are a natural person. So only people get the credit, not businesses, not partnerships, not other corporate entities such as that. The reason for that is angel investing is not just people putting money into companies, it's adding their expertise to those companies. And so we want actual people involved. In terms of other investors, we also allow funds to make investments. Funds must have a minimum of at least 3 natural person investors. Only those natural person investors qualify for the credit. Finally, we have the businesses. And there's a number of requirements for the businesses. First of all, they must be headquartered in Minnesota. They must have a minimum of at least 51% of their employees and 51% of their payroll in Minnesota. We have some minimum wage requirements. Primarily, that is that employees of these new high-tech businesses must pay their employees at least 175% of the poverty level for a family of 4. Currently, that's $39,113 per year. If you work that out on an hourly basis, it's about $1,880 an hour. This does not apply to the business's executives, officers, board members, or 20% owners. In addition, the business cannot have been in operation for more than 10 years and cannot have received equity investments of more than $4 million. Again, this is for small, new businesses. We have a number of business types that qualify for the credit. I'll just sort of summarize it by saying, basically, it's for those that are using some sort of proprietary technology to create a product or a process, or doing research on a proprietary technology to create a product or a process. In addition, we have some specific industry types that do qualify if they're using new proprietary technology, and that would be in agriculture, tourism, forestry, mining, manufacturing, and transportation.
Mr. Nelson, if you could hold that thought there, I'm going to interrupt you. We do have a quorum now. Officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Knuth moves the minutes of February 23rd. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Knuth. Okay, with that, members, Representative Downey moves House File 1823. And so we will continue to discuss House File 1823. Mr. Nelson, you have the floor. And sorry for the interruption, but we needed to do a few housekeeping details. We do have an A1 amendment. Representative Downey, why don't you join us here a second? So when Mr. Nelson is talking, he's talking to the bill as you want it amended. Could you just briefly describe what the A1 amendment does?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members will notice in the bill on page 15, section 4, we were initially thinking that we might be able to increase the amount of the credit available after conferring with the chair and others. I think that's maybe not possible here in the long term, so rather than have that be a major bone of contention or discussion here today, we're striking page 15, section 4, to make sure that the credit stays at its currently funded amount as compared to increased to $20 million.
Any discussion? Anyone from the audience like to testify for or against the A1 amendment? If not, Richard Downey moves the H1823A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have this part of the bill in the order the author would like. Mr. Nelson, thank you for letting us do some housekeeping here. If you could please continue your presentation, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll transition now into reporting on some of the statistics of the program, 2010 versus 2011. You'll remember that the program began in 2010 and was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor March 31st or April, and we launched the program in July of 2010. So the 2010 statistics are really for half a year. In 2010, we certified 112 businesses. In 2011, that increased to 176 businesses. Of those businesses, in 2010, 67 were invested in, whereas in 2011, 113 were invested in. In terms of number of investors, we went from certifying 275 investors in 2010 to 623 in 2011. The majority of those investors did invest in our companies. So out of the 275 in 2010, 258 invested, 623 in 2011, 563 invested in our new high-tech businesses in the state. We also have funds that participate in the program, angel funds. In 2010, we had five that were certified and four invested. In 2011, that jumped up to 21 that were certified, and all of them, all 21, participated in investing in new companies. In 2010, we issued $7 million in credits. We had $11 million, but because it was only half a year, we just used $7 million. That resulted in $28 million invested in these new businesses. The extra $4 million carried over to 2011. In 2011, we had a base of $12 million in credits, plus the $4 million carryover, which gave us $16 million in credits. $16 million in credits equals $64 million in investments. The source of our funds, the source of the investment, as I said before, it is a refundable credit, so even out-of-state residents, out-of-state participants can gain benefit from the program. Last year, 71% of the investors were from Minnesota. This year, 73% were from Minnesota. The average investment in 2010 was just short of $100,000. I don't have the numbers yet for 2011. The types of businesses that received investment in both years, 2010 and 2011, remain the same. The top four categories were medical devices, software, biotech, and clean tech. Where did the investment take place in the state? Last year, in 2011, we had six businesses in greater Minnesota that were able to take an investment out of the 67, meaning that six were in greater Minnesota, 61 were in the metro area. In 2011, we were able to increase that such that 11 businesses in greater Minnesota took part in the program and received investment. And in the metro area, it was 102 businesses. However, probably more telling is that in 2010, only $1.8 million was invested in the greater Minnesota businesses. That more than quadrupled in 2011, that those 11 businesses received $8.4 million. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments on the program so far. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Questions for Mr. Nelson, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelson, I know the program isn't quite 2 years old, but those businesses that were invested in, are they, I'll use the term survival, are they still functioning or have any of them failed? And then I have a second follow-up question.
Mr. Nelson.
To my knowledge at this point, none of the businesses have failed.
Representative Carlson.
Okay, and that's good news. Being at their higher risk, I was curious how successful they've been. And then the other question I had, you referenced investing in companies that are doing research on potential new products. And are any of those spinoffs from the University of Minnesota?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, yes, a number of them are from the university. I don't have a number, but I know a number of them are affiliated or were born at the U, so to speak.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I raised that question, we've had a history of trying to get more spinoffs from the University of Minnesota. Often some of those technologies, patents and so on, have gone to entities outside of Minnesota. And so I would view that as a positive if some of these are spinoffs from the University of Minnesota and then are becoming Minnesota-based companies. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Questions for Mr. Nelson? Okay, we'll go to Mr. Alexander. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Alexander. I represent Angel Investors. Twin Cities Angels is an organization I belong to, but I'm also an individual investor.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you very much. In making modifications to the Angel Investment Tax Credit, we had recommended four categories of changes, the first of which was just adjusted, which was raising the amount to match our neighbor Wisconsin at $20 million. I won't discuss that since that's been pulled off the table. The other three categories are, one, the hourly wage rate, the issues Representative Downey raised relative to gaming the system, and basic information rights. In no particular order, the original bill did not allow the Department of Economic Development to provide information on those qualified companies that would allow an angel investor to contact them, information such as their address, their website, if they had one, and many of them do not, email addresses, phone numbers, and a brief description of what the company did. That is probably the easiest change. We recommend it. The second category is hourly wages. There is both a restriction for employees of the company and interns along the wages that Jeff Nelson just mentioned. Early stage companies tend to attract unusual mix of people relative to more established businesses. The people that are attracted tend to be deep in skills. They are rarely opportunities for people right out of the job market, with the exception of internships. And so the people that join them tend to be interested in the opportunity to build something completely new, applying skills that they have in great depth. So their compensation tends to match with that opportunity. They are in many cases willing to take a lower wage in exchange for equity. For instance, the last two companies that I personally have started, I am an entrepreneur, every employee down to the part-time clerical worker has had equity position in the company. But as a result, the wages are a little low because cash is one of the most precious resources. When you run out of cash, all activity stops. And so the wages tend to be a little bit low. So as a result, their aggregate compensation is really based on the future performance of the company. The wages of roughly $40,000 a year is frankly an impediment for companies that are outside of a high income area such as the metro area to accept the angel investment tax credit and therefore bring in capital. I have letters from a number of CEOs from outstate saying, I love the idea, but if somebody's willing to take $8 to $10 an hour, I can't pay them $19. And so both their urging and our urging is that those wage restrictions be released. It's also worth noting that of the 29 other states that have angel investment tax credits, only a handful have similar wage restrictions. They all have the restrictions that we have in terms of technology, markets, high growth, maximum amount of capital raised, and so on, but they don't restrict the wages. Should I entertain questions at this point or after I finish the other areas?
We'll open up for some questions right now for Mr. Alexander, and if there are none, we'll continue, but we'll open up for questions at this point. Members, do you have questions of Mr. Alexander on his presentation to this point? If not, please continue, sir.
Thank you. The last area involves gaming. There were opportunities before the changes that are proposed in this bill for individuals to invest in companies that were public, invest in companies with knowledge that a liquidity event, a purchase of the company or an IPO of the company was pending. And in both of those two situations, there would be a windfall in a relatively short period of time that flies in the face of the intent of this bill, which is to get people to invest when the risk is high, early in the company's development, where there's where the date associated with a liquidity event is unknown. So the language that's in the modifications restricts any claws back any tax credit if those events occur within the next 6 months. And that was based on discussions between Jeff Nelson and myself on the simplest language in order to achieve that objective. Third, there is a convertible debt component to this, which has caused some confusion in the industry. Debt as a category of investment is by its very nature less risk because it tends to be secured by assets, intellectual property, or it is superior to other forms of equity such as common or preferred stock that would allow those investors some protection. It was put into the bill late into the process, and frankly, I missed it, or I would have provided comments on it at an earlier time. But the convertible feature requires that that conversion occur within 3 years. And the approval of tax credits for those individuals who have made convertible debt investments only requires that three-year period. If, in fact, a conversion occurs at an earlier time, then there's, as I understand it, a complex process where A, deed has to find out about that, and B, they have to go back through a clawback on a pro rata basis. So it becomes a situation where companies have used language that has said that the conversion must occur within 3 years, but if it occurs in 1 year, then here's how that conversion occurs, or that repayment of the debt occurs, or some other event occurs. You know, convertible debt is useful if the company goes bankrupt, but in terms of an inducement relative to the tax credit, there has been, in my opinion, some gaming. And so our recommendation would be to either not allow any other provision but conversion in 3 years, or strike the use of debt altogether. And that concludes my prepared comments.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Alexander? Thank you very much, sir. Okay, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So real briefly then, you can look through sections 2 through 5 of the bill and see the changes that Mr. Alexander referenced, again noting that we've amended out the increase to $20 million. And I think rather than walking you through one by one those changes, you can read them and probably correlate them to his comments. A couple of additional things. I have met with Mr. Nelson. The department disagrees with a couple of the provisions or the suggestions that are in the bill, and the bill is roughly consistent with Mr. Alexander's suggestions, and we've had a good conversation. I think we can come to terms on almost all of these, and I want to also make mention that they have agreed to something that I requested as well. I think the department would be fine with this, and that is companies that are in a very, very long FDA approval sequence, perhaps even multiple FDA approvals, sometimes can't fit under the 10-year window that the bill has today, and so they were willing to grant that for companies that are locked in an FDA approval cycle, that they could extend that to 20 years and still be eligible. And then Representative Murray has authored a bill, even, I think, I don't know if it's dropped in, that would address this Greater Minnesota versus Metro. I'll call it an issue, but pretty clearly there isn't a lot of the angel credit being taken advantage of in the greater Minnesota area, and so he has some ideas, and I'm receptive to those, whether we would actually try and hard code into the law some percentage of the credit that has to be in the greater Minnesota area or not. I don't know. That might be too prescriptive, but something that at least tracks and monitors this, and Mr. Alexander brought up the question of the minimum wage, the minimum salary provision that might be an impediment and a barrier in the rural areas as well. What I'd like to suggest to members is the provisions in my bill pretty much represent the suggestions of the Angel community. The provisions of Representative Murray's bill try to get at this rural metro, greater Minnesota metro divide. And then the department has a bill that Representative Mahoney is carrying that has their kind of subset of Mr. Alexander's points that they agree with. And I think we can all come to terms on that. And I know we're laying the bill over here. So rather than try and conjure up the all-encompassing amendment here today, I just want to make members know that we're receptive to continuing the conversation and make sure we tweak this thing in the right way and make sure the department's comfortable with it as well as the investor community.
Did you see the angelic community?
Yeah, I did.
I could have, but I think I said investor.
Oh, okay.
Angelic. Selective interpretation.
Okay.
By the chair.
Mr. Nelson, we've got some questions. On the issue of paying like the $40,000 a year, $19 an hour, and maybe this is to Mr. Downey or Mr. Nelson, are there provisions that if you went to a $12 or $11 and had options, do those options count as a wage as far as meeting that requirement?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Nelson.
We view we don't just view wages, we view the full compensation. So if there are fringe benefits such as health insurance, vacation time, other things like that, we count that as part of the compensation. So when we say, when we mention the figure of almost $40,000 a year, we consider that to be full compensation, not just wages.
Mr. Nelson, how do you count options?
We do not count options.
Okay.
Because we cannot value those.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, going back to my earlier question about the number of businesses involved that were spinoffs from the University of Minnesota, what would the mix look like, Greater Metro versus Greater Minnesota, if you factored that out? Because we have located here the largest research institution in the state. The only one is right in the heart of the Twin Cities. And if that's where a lot of these businesses are being spun off from, you know, I'd like to see a greater distribution. I think that would be fair. But if a lot of that is related to the University of Minnesota, what would your mix be?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson. Again, I don't have the specific number of businesses from the university. However, it would not be an extremely large number. 5 to 10, so I don't think it's not going to affect the mix that greatly.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, your earlier answer led me to believe that there were perhaps more spinoffs from the university, but that number probably wouldn't change the mix that much. Thank you.
To that point, Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just an overriding point about the credit. This thing is structured in a way that the investors receive a credit as an incentive to continue to do business here through a more favorable tax climate for these kinds of investment opportunities. And outside of the fact that we said in the bill we'd like them to go generally to high-tech or emerging tech or newer technology-oriented companies, you know, we haven't written in here who those investors need to invest in, and I'd be really concerned with and would frankly oppose anything where we would try and hard code that into state law and, for example, say we want to give some kind of a preference to the University of Minnesota and their spinoffs. The reality is the University of Minnesota and their spinoffs have got to produce good opportunities and create nice investment opportunities and compete with everybody else across the state who's doing the same thing, and you let the market work. You provide a bit of a tax climate incentive, but you don't use the power of state statute to tell people where and how and in what kinds of ventures they should be investing. So I'd steer away from trying to do anything that would create a specific benefit or a preference for the University of Minnesota. This is just designed to make the market a little more attractive for folks, and then let's let the market work.
Mr. Nelson, as far as the outstate areas, are we talking Rochester, Duluth, Mankato?
Mr. Chair, we differentiate between the 11-county metro area and the rest of the state.
Okay, so in the rest of the state, do we see some development in Rochester or Mankato or Duluth or...
Mr. Chair,
Dilworth,
by March 15th, we will have our annual report ready for the legislature, and we plan on including there a map of where all the businesses are, so you'll have a clearer picture. I think you won't be surprised to see the concentration in the metro area, as we talked about, and along what is sort of commonly referred as the I-94 Highway 52 corridor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nelson. Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if Representative Downey was responding to my question, but I was only asking it not from the standpoint of fencing any particular institution, the university, for example, in or out. I was asking it for a statistical purpose to compare the mixture of Greater Minnesota relative to the Twin Cities, and if that mixture was influenced one way or another when he was sharing the numbers of businesses in the Twin Cities versus Greater Minnesota. But I wasn't talking about fencing.
Representative Downey? Okay. Okay, other questions for Mr. Nelson or Representative Downey on this portion of the bill? If not, Representative Downey, why don't we move to your second portion of the bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A brief introduction of the Small Business Investment Company credit provision in the bill. And for those of you who remember the CAPCO bills that have come before this committee and that members on both sides of the aisle have authored over the years, this is kind of the most finely tuned of those, the 2012 version of those. And what I'd like to do, just by way of introduction, and then Mr. Cassidy has some testimony to provide. He can explain kind of in a little more detail how the program works. But I think probably everyone around here wishes we had, I can speak for myself. I wish we had a much more favorable overall business climate, and we have some challenges there. And I think we've recognized that by saying we need to provide some tax preferences and some investment incentives down at the earliest stages. And we did that with the Angel Investment Tax Credit, and we're starting to see some of the activity in the market as a result of that more favorable tax treatment. And so the Business Investment Company Credit extends that up to companies that are a little bigger, that are ready to grow, that are ready to scale, but perhaps aren't quite bankable yet. And I think we all understand that banks have their risk tolerances dialed way down. Some of that's regulatory, some of that's just their own management of their own risk. And so there are a lot of businesses out there that hit this, what many would call the valley of death, where they've taken all of the early stage investment from family members and friends and close associates in the angel network, but they aren't quite ready for a big round of venture capital or an institutional bank funded round of financing. And it's interesting, 10 years ago, venture capital firms were really playing down in this area, and they aren't anymore. Venture capital firms are looking for much more sure thing types of investments. They aren't taking the high risk early stage things. And so this is an attempt to provide some tax incentives to enliven investment down in that smaller area. I will note, and we might get into some of this in discussion, but this is, again, just one more piece on the continuum that I think we need to deal with. We have, I think, even bigger problems. If we have a more favorable tax climate for these really early stage angel startups, if we can do something to make our tax climate more favorable for these small, growing, still fairly high risk ventures that the business investment credit tries to deal with, we still have the problem that once these companies really scale and they get profitable and they've got markets and customers and products that they know are going to work, we have to ask ourselves whether our overall business tax climate in Minnesota is going to be attractive enough to keep them here, or whether we're going to continue to see this increasing trend, this problem trend, of companies getting to the point where they're finally ready to become profitable, actually generate income and taxes in Minnesota, and then they leave. And all the jobs go with them, and the manufacturing plants are overseas or they're in one of our neighboring states. So I just want to make sure people understand where this business investment company credit fits in that overall continuum. And with that, I'll let Mr. Cassidy explain the program a little bit, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Donnie, should we move the 624 amendment first to get the bill in the shape you would prefer?
That would be great, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, before we do that, I'd like to thank Mr. Nelson for his presentation and also Mr. Alexander for his presentation. So, questions on the 624 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? Anybody from the audience like to testify on behalf of or with concerns? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the shape the author would like it. Mr. Cassidy, welcome to the Tax Committee, sir. If you could please state your name, who you represent for the record, and make your presentation, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street & Dinard. Just to follow on Representative Downey's comments, this bill is in both sections is all about unlocking capital. This program has been around in various forms in around the country for about 15 years. It originally was called the CAPCO program. It's been around in various renditions and names for the last 15 years, and right now it's been implemented in 12 states. It's been reauthorized over 30 times. The state of Texas, I think, is on their third or fourth reauthorization of these tax credits. And the concept is pretty simple. First and foremost is there's a need for capital in the marketplace and to help these companies that are in their growth stage. Number two is insurers have reserves that they need to invest, and those reserves are regulated by the state of Minnesota. Each state insurance regulator regulates the reserves of the companies domiciled in their state. Companies that have participated in this program include Mutual of Omaha, Allstate, Zurich, a lot of common names that you see on TV and that many of you are insured with today. The Department of Economic Development is charged with going out and certifying investment managers. And investment managers are probably venture capital firms, firms that make investments in companies. They're professionals that find companies that are in need of capital, and they make investments in them, and they help manage their companies, and hopefully to grow jobs and to grow tax revenues. The funding from to make these investments obviously comes from the insurers. The insurers are incented to do this through a tax credit. In Representative Downey's bill, the tax credit is 85%, so 85 cents on the dollar tax credit. That tax credit would not kick in for 4 years from the day of enactment. So you would have, in this bill, $100 million of capital available for 4 years before the tax credits would kick in. And then you would pay those tax credits back to the insurer against their premium tax obligation for the next 5 years. So you have a 9-year time window, 4 years putting the capital to work, 5 more years paying back the tax credits. The idea is that those tax credits would be paid back through these businesses growing and tax revenues growing at the same time. Representative Downey has offered up an amendment, I believe, that you have before you that would require an economic impact model be implemented so that these companies, these investment managers, would have to prove that they have generated the economic activity in order to pay back the tax credits over time during the program. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like me to, I can walk through the bill section by section very briefly.
Well, my first question is, in the Jobs Committee, they had very nice blue printed forms, and we get black and white.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. The lobbyist room in the Capitol only has a black and white copy.
Okay. There you go. That's a good thing. Okay, why don't you walk us through the bill, then we do have some folks with some members with questions. And so why don't you walk us through the bill, then we'll go get into questions. Mr. Cassidy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Beginning with Section 1. Section 1 is the definitional section. A couple things to highlight, first and foremost, are what qualifies a business to actually be in this program. And you have to be a business located in Minnesota. You have to have at least 80% of your employees located here in your principal operations in Minnesota. No more than 100 employees. And you can't be engaged in a number of businesses, including banking, gaming, oil and gas exploration, some of the risky high-end businesses. Subdivision 2, certification. This is a certification process for the business investment managers that will actually go out and make these investments and find the businesses that need capital. There's a high bar here, a $7,500 registration fee, and you have to have $500,000 in capitalization. And I believe you also have to submit audited financials to the department before certification as well. Requirements of the investment, the investor, meaning the insurance company, they can't be more than a 15% investor in one investment company. Subdivision 5. These are the benchmarks and the thresholds for which the business managers must invest and put the capital on the street. Within 2 years, they have to invest 35% of the capital that they have. Within 3 years, 50%. 4 years, 60. 6 years, 100%. These can change. Think about accelerating these or get the capital out quicker, but it's meant to keep the investment company out on the street working hard, getting capital out. One thing to point out in this section as well, the investment company cannot pull out any distributions until they have 100% of the capital invested in companies and out on the street. Going to reporting requirements, these are annual reporting requirements to the department. The investment managers must submit audited financials. They have to certify that they haven't put more than 15% of their funds in any one business. And job information in terms of how many jobs were in a company once they invested, how many jobs they have at the end of the year, any terminated investments, and also anything else that the Department of Economic Development requires as well. And then finally is the reporting requirements to the governor and the legislature. This is an annual requirement that would go to, that Deed would have to submit to the governor and the legislature, which would address how many investment companies there are in Minnesota, the amount of designated capital that they have available, what they've invested, the number of employees that companies have, how many employees they have at the end of the investment, locations of the company, and any other information that's requested by the governor and legislature. And finally, the last section of the bill addresses the investment credits themselves to the insurance companies. And again, these are tax credits that won't kick in till 2016, 4 years from now, and they're paid out over 5 years. You'll see the schedule on the last page of the summary, and that is in tax year 2016, 10% of the tax credit can be paid out, the next year 15%, and the following 3 years 20% more in each of those 3 years. Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Before we get to questions for Mr. Cassidy, is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on behalf of or with concerns on this House file 1823 as amended? Okay, so we'll go to questions for Mr. Cassidy and the author, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess maybe it's for Representative Downey. To Mr. Cassidy, though, I don't think he meant what he said. I don't know if Mr. Cassidy saw a bunch of us flinch when you said that this money comes from the insurers. And I think you were probably talking about the mechanics of the bill, but I think for the public who may be watching, the money comes from the taxpayers to pay for this program if we were to do it. It's a $100 million program that the taxpayers of Minnesota would pay for. So in the testimony, I just didn't want it to be lost when it was said this money would come from the insurers. That's how the mechanics of the bill works. If we did this bill, we would take $100 million from the state budget and give it to the insurers, who then would make these decisions, and we may or may not get a reward from that situation. But I just want to get that on the record, because I know Mr. Cassidy, and I don't think he was trying to say that this wouldn't be a taxpayer-funded program. I do have a question, though, one for you, Mr. Chair. We didn't hear, and I know we all do things differently, but I notice when we hear bills, you tend not to have people talk about the fiscal notes. And Ms. Templin is our person that works in the House who explains generally the fiscal notes that the Department of Revenue has put together, even though for the public, again, she works for the House, not for the Department of Revenue. She doesn't come up with them, but she walks us through them. And, you know, since we're not doing that, I will just note, and it didn't come up in Representative Downey's testimony either, this bill has a zero price tag on it. But members, this bill costs $100 million a year. It's been creatively drafted to have the cost begin in 2016. So as members think about this bill, this would be $100 million for all time from our budget. Now, I think we'll get the argument here. It just naturally follows in this committee that some will say, you know, that's not money from the taxpayers because it's a tax expenditure, so it's actually just letting someone keep their own money and it's a tax cut. But I think this committee is smart enough to understand that that means everybody else who doesn't get the tax cut pays higher taxes, so someone else can have a tax cut. Or if we then cut the budget to find that $100 million every year, our residents will continue to pay the same amount in taxes and get less for it. So it's one or the other. Either we find the money to pay for this bill and everyone else pays a little bit more in taxes, or, as I think more of the conservatives would argue, you get to keep your own money. But even Representative Gottwald, who's signaling at me, will understand that if we then cut the state government $100 million a year to pay for Representative Downey's bill, our residents will pay the same level of taxes but get less for it. So that's the inherent cost in a choice like this. So because we haven't heard that as part of the bill, I just want to make sure people understand this is a $100 million cost. But my question is, and maybe, Mr. Chair, it's Representative Downey can take a shot at, and if he can't answer it, then maybe it's staff. My understanding on CAPCO, and I've always thought that name was a tricky name, I don't know what it stands for, is it CAP companies that invest in capital? I always thought it should be called CAPCON, because I think if people at the Capitol fall for this, you've been conned. This is you taking money from the state budget and then giving it to insurance companies who wouldn't ever do this, so they have to first go in and securitize the risk, and then they have to spend the money so fast to meet the qualifications of the bill that they don't do high-risk investment, they do safe investment. And in fact, the bill walks through a process where the money, you have to spend 35% of the money in 2 years, you have to spend 50% of $100 million in 3 years, and you have to spend 60% of $100 million in 6 years just to qualify. So it forces these investors to take not high-risk investments, but actually safer ones. But the question is, and for Representative Downey or Mr. Cassidy, I don't think it's fair to Mr. Cassidy because he's not lobbying for the angel credit. Or maybe then it goes to Mr. Michaels. The way I understand it is the angel credit, you know, has more risk than I like. And Representative Downey, you know that very well, but you've got both of these things going on in this bill. But the CAPCO, as I read your bill, is 85% of the risk falls on the people of Minnesota and 15% falls on the investors. And I think it could, you know, if that's not right, I'd like to hear it, but the way I read it is 85% will fall on our residents to take this risk and 15% to the investors. And then, is the angel credit, I believe, is significantly less risk than the CAPCO proposal. So could you tell me how you view these, what the numbers are you put on, taxpayer versus investor, for the two ideas?
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski. I'm trying to remember all of the comments you made to try and address them. But maybe I can just try and explain the thinking behind this. First of all, we are getting back into the classic discussion of whether a tax credit is actually spending by the state. I think that's a misnomer, and you weren't here for the presentation of my bill where I tried to articulate that and change some of that language. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I would totally disagree that allowing insurance companies a credit against their premium tax is somehow state spending. It is indeed a loss of revenue, and that would be fair characterization, but to say that the Minnesota taxpayers are spending money is not accurate. A couple of things that you mentioned that I don't think fit the bill as it stands. Number one, we reduced the amount in the amendment from $100 million to $75 million, and members should note that that's a one-time credit amount, not a recurring annual. This program would have to be reauthorized at the end of the 4 or 5 year or 9 year period, depending on how you wanted to look at it. And then this credit program uniquely, Representative Lencheski, in the 624 amendment says that the credit would not even be paid by the state unless there is an economic assessment done that shows that the economic impact of the investments have actually paid for more than paid for the credit. So this one has a bit of an ironclad guarantee. So I think this is even by design and by definition probably zero risk to taxpayers. And then with this additional thing here, we don't even issue the credit unless you can prove that there was more income generated for the state than the credit would be granted to the premium taxes on the insurance companies. So I just fundamentally disagree with your assumption. You know what, if it were me and I could, you know what, we'd eliminate the corporate income tax and we'd eliminate the personal income tax for every person, LLP, every LLC, every individual investing in small companies. And you know what, we'd have an angel investment, Jobsy, Minnesota tax zone that would incentivize investment all over the place. But we're not going to do that because we have a governor who would never sign that. He wants to go in the other direction. So what we're left with is these very targeted places where we reduce the tax liability of certain companies, certain investors, because they are doing something that we want. And we can argue about whether that's good policy or not, but to characterize it as state spending is totally inconsistent with the language of the bill, and I think inconsistent with just the premise of a tax credit that goes to folks who are doing a highly valuable activity.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't get an answer to the question, though, which is, and the notes have been sent to me, and I'm not sure who's sending them all to me, but people in this room know the answer, and the answer is that in the CAPCO bill, 85% of the risk would be borne by taxpayers and 15% by the investors, and in the angel credit it's 25% risk by the taxpayers and 75% by the investors. So members, think long about this one. I will just say, Representative Downey, I know you were talking to Mr. Cassidy, and having been an author of a lot of bills, I know there's a lot going on, and I don't think you heard what I said. The language that you have that brings it, I guess, down to 75, so I did not know that, but you say unless there's a win to the state, where there is no language that says you're going to measure the amount of economic activity that would happen anyway. And I think we know that mostly the activity that's going to happen state happens anyhow. You have to just measure the net new as a result of your bill. So, you know, Mr. Chair, I think we should just start passing bills to abolish the income tax and the corporate tax and just put them out in the window. You know, just say that'll cost $6 billion someday in the future, and because that'll just spur economic development and jobs, we just don't need to have any taxes. I mean, this is the argument we keep having, that if we just give out tax credits to people, magic will happen, and it will more than pay for itself. And it was that simple. I mean, I'm with Representative Downey. I have a bill to get rid of the corporate tax this year. I mean, let's you know, that I just think the concern here, and Representative Downey, I think, like I said, did not hear what I was saying. I do think very liberal people here believe tax expenditures are government spending, and I think very conservative people think they are letting people keep their money. I think in the middle is an indisputable fact that if we do a program like this, and we force we won't have to make up for it with a tax increase. We force the state government to cut to pay for this program, which is, you can ask Representative Holberg, she'll tell you. Your bill passes, somebody has to find $75 million a year to make this bill go through. The people who are still paying taxes may pay the exact same. They may not get a tax increase, as a lot of liberals would say, but they're going to get less government for the same dollar they spent the day before, because we're instead going to move that dollar to some preferential treatment. And that's okay. I mean, some people here would rather invest money in K-12 or higher ed or roads. You'd rather give tax credits to these folks. So that's perfectly okay. But to say there's not a cost in budgeting and choices and preferences that have to be made, I mean, setting aside sort of the liberal and conservative dogma and just saying the facts around here, this is a very expensive bill. It's very inefficient. I don't think the angel credit is so great, but angel credit trumps this significantly, members. 85% of the money of this bill comes from our residents, and the investors take almost no risk. In the angel credit, it's the converse. The investors take 75% of the risk, and the taxpayers 25%. So I don't know if Representative Downey didn't know that about those two formulas, and I sure hope, Mr. Chair, if you can find the money to do things like this as opposed to fixing the marriage penalty or bringing back the homestead credit, you will make sure that it's 85% of the burden on the investor and 15% of the burden on the Minnesota taxpayer. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lincheski. And members, you do have from the Department of Revenue the numbers right here, and the reason I don't bring up Ms. Templin to do these is because I'd like Representative Lincheski to ask me to. And so would you like to hear from Ms. Templin? We sure can.
No, Mr. Chair, I think between Representative Downey and I mean, he didn't deny that it. I was wrong. I thought it was $100 million a year. He's saying it's 75. But if you just look at it, you can see the zeros. So in 2016, it kicks in as $75 million for all time. And I think Representative Downey is agreeing that is the price tag to this bill.
Once. For all time, once.
Yes.
Well, I don't think that's right, so maybe you do want Mrs. Templin here.
Ms. Templin, can you please join us and just run through this? This is very important, and I want to make sure that we're saying the right things here. My understanding, it's in 2016, $75 million one time. Or 15 per year. Okay, over 5 years. Ms. Templin, could you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and tell us what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I have the revenue estimate for House File 1823 dated February 27, 2012. And what you see for the Minnesota Business Investment Credit are zeros from fiscal 2012 to fiscal 15. And with the amendment, with the A12-0624 amendment, there is a $75 million limitation over 5 years on this credit. So there would be a revenue loss of $75 million from fiscal 16 to fiscal 20. And for the angel investment credit, with the amendment, the A1 amendment that was adopted earlier, there would be a zero revenue impact in fiscal 12 through fiscal 15. The current law would remain the funding. There would be no increase. Mr. Chair, does that provide?
Ms. Templin, what happens after the five-year time frame?
The allocation expires. After this, there's a $75 million cap, and that amount would be, after fiscal 20, would expire.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, okay.
And then I do have a list of folks when we get back to Mr. Cassidy and Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I apologize, I didn't even have a chance to look at the fiscal or the revenue note until we got to committee today, or we could have perhaps had a more comprehensive discussion of it. But I mean, Representative Lencheski has her perspective on these things, and I don't follow it, and I think the presentation of it is very misleading. You know, you can look at the back pages of the bill, the section 6 on page 18. It talks about the kind of minimum distribution of the investments by the companies, which would generate the tax over the 5-year period. It is a one-time allocation, and I think we've cleared up that basic piece of misinformation. But in general, this language that the state somehow owns 85% of the risk. The state doesn't own any of the risk. If the investment company invests in crummy companies, they'll lose all their money. The state has 100% of the tax credit to pay out, assuming that the companies actually that are invested in actually generate enough return to the state to warrant it. And I don't know about you, but that sounds like a 0% risk to me and 100% risk on the investors. Yes, we have made a commitment to those insurance companies who participate in this program through these investment, these business investment companies. We have made a commitment to them to offer them that kind of a tax relief and that kind of a tax preference. No one's disputing that. But to reinterpret this and somehow assume that the state is making decisions about investment risk, it's totally confusing the issue. So this is just a very simple program that allows insurance companies the opportunity to get a premium credit if they invest in small businesses that frankly aren't getting the investment right now. And Representative Lencheski made a really, really, really good point about the net new activity as compared to simply rewarding them for what would have happened already. And I think if you look at the impact of the angel investment tax credit itself, we have increased early stage investment dramatically in Minnesota. We're kind of back in the game now. So I think you could argue that a lot of what's happening with the angel program is really net new activity. It's stuff that would not have happened absent that program. Argue all you want about whether states should be competing like this or what have you, but it is net new activity. And I'm going to point this out in committee and on the floor over and over and over again that Representative Lencheski is exactly right about net new activity with regard to bonding bills. And everybody who runs around talking about how many jobs are going to get created by bonding bills, when in fact the investment in those bonds is coming out of the private sector and investors in Minnesota who would have been investing it in something else, she's exactly right. We need to look at the opportunity cost of all of these programs, and I think these investment credits actually stand up pretty well when you look at how dry the early stage investment market was in Minnesota before we started realizing we had to probably compete as unseemly as it was. So I want us to hold on to that thought that we got to look at the net new activity on all fronts when we consider these programs.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. You know, we all want to create jobs. That's the number one goal here. But House File 1823, the model that is set up here for venture capital is seriously flawed. Seriously flawed. There is not one incentive or one reward for these capcos to create one new job. In fact, the way the model is set up is that, despite what you just heard, the state taxpayer is going to assume the risk. The state taxpayer is going to put forward all of the funds. All of the profits will go to the capcos, and the end result, almost no new jobs. That's the record that we've seen in these states that have had this. And Mr. Cassidy, you mentioned a number of states that have had the program. There have been more states that have rejected the program, and some of the states that initially had the program have either eliminated the program or backed away because they've seen the lack of results. And, you know, almost every independent study of the CAPCO program has showed abysmal results, terrible results. And let me give you some, then I'm going to talk about a traditional venture capital program versus this CAPCO model. And you're going to see where the risk is in the state taxpayer. and not what you heard earlier here. In Florida, when they actually, you know, Mr. Cassidy just passed this out. Many of these data points that mention jobs created, many of those numbers were taken directly from the four main CAPCOs. There are about four main CAPCOs around the nation that would take that get about 80% of these funds to invest in businesses. And that's because they already have pretty good relationship with these insurance companies, and the way the bills are written, they're ready to go. And I can give you those, but at any rate, most of these states, or most of this data right here, is using data from those four CAPCOs. In fact, one study was co-sponsored by the Missouri Chamber of Commerce. But where you have had the states independently look at this CAPCO program, let me give you some of the results. In Florida, a 2007 government state report said Florida had invested $150 million. Net new job growth, 20. And in fact, in 2005, when they initially did the report, it looked like it had lost 180 jobs. But by 2007, net gain of 20. In Missouri, and you'll see one from Missouri, but again, that one was using money from CAPCOs. The state auditor did a report in 2004, and of the $140 million invested, 293 jobs. That's one job per every $477,000 invested. In District of Columbia, the district auditor went in, and even though $76 million was allocated, only $22 million was invested. I'm going to talk about why that is in just a second. $22 million, 31 new jobs created, according to this auditor's report. One job for $709,000 of investment. In New York, 2007 state audit, $400 million put in by state taxpayers. Jobs created, 1,059. That's one job for every $377,000. Texas, I can go on here. As I looked at where you actually, and by the way, it's tough to get a hold of this info because not a lot of independent state audits have looked at these programs. But in the ones I have here, it basically comes to one job for every $425,000 invested. And here's why. A traditional venture capitalist is this. I am a wealthy person. I'm a wealthy investor. And I got $100 to spend. I am going to go to Mr. Carlson, who's a venture capitalist. And I'm going to go to him because he has a proven record of making good investments. He now will go to Representative Erickson, who is a fledgling business, a high-risk early business. And he is going to invest in that business, take that $100 and invest in that business in exchange for some equity, ownership in that business. And he is going to help make decisions. He's going to suffer in the profits and loss. He's going to have real skin in the game. And the hope for him is that he can get this business to make a big profit, either sell it to a larger business or make it attractive stock for the stock market. The only way he makes any money is by making a profit. So Mr. Carlson, Representative Carlson, the only way he makes a profit is if Representative Erickson's businesses, after it's sold, have made a good profit. So let's say he makes $150 on that $100 investment. The investor, right here, I will get all $100 of my initial capital plus 80% of the profits. Representative Carlson keeps 20% of the profits plus any management fees, which are roughly about 2.5%. So there is huge incentive here to pick businesses, and most of them are high risk. I mean, 50% are going to fail. But when they get that business that really makes the money, they really get there. So they're going to be early on, high risk, high growth businesses. Okay, here's the model for CAPCO. I am the investor, but the investor is the state taxpayer. I'm the Minnesota taxpayer, and I am giving out $75 million in credits. So I'm going to now give out $75 to insurance companies in a form of credits. And I'm going to give that again to Representative Carlson, who's an insurance company. He's now going to invest in these CAPCOs, who then, let's say Representative Coonan is a CAPCO. He will give $75 to the CAPCO. to invest. Now, what Representative Conan's going to do in this CAPCO, the first thing he's going to do is to make sure that the insurance company gets all their money back. So he's going to put about half of that $75, let's say $35, into safe havens, treasury bonds, that over 10 or 12 years will double. So he makes sure that the insurance company gets their money back. No risk on the insurance company. Which means only half of what I have invested as a taxpayer is actually going to get invested into these new businesses. Because he took half of it typically to make sure he can put it in treasury bonds to pay back, after it doubles, all of what they owe to the insurance company. So the insurance companies get the benefit. They'll get the $75 credit, no matter what. All right. Now, the way the bill works out, you notice that the way the CAPCO makes the profit is when they decertify after they spent 100% of all the money they received. In this case, it's $75. Representative Coonan has to spend that $75 within 6 years. In fact, he has to spend 50% of it within 3 years. He's got to spend $75, and yet he only has $37 left because he gave $37 in these treasury bonds, which means he's got to turn those dollars over twice. He's got to roll them over. And so, whereas in the first case, it was to get long-term equity, work it, here the profit, the incentive for the profit is not in a high-growth business. It's in churning out those dollars as fast as you can. Because once he has spent the $75, he keeps the $75, and that's his profit. Doesn't matter whether or not the businesses that he invests in are successful or not. Because he's been assured the $75 that came from me, the taxpayer. That's it. So what they have found on these CAPCOs around the nation, and this is why there's so little job growth, is that typically 50% of that $37 is going to be in form of a loan. And I just heard Mr. Alexander say that a loan is very low risk because they're assured of getting the principal plus interest back. So it doesn't really matter what the business does. And what they have found out, in the state of Colorado, they spent $8.8 million on 13 companies. Every one of the companies were established companies that could quickly pay back the loans. So he can get that $37 back. He can roll over quickly because he's got to do it in another 3 years. And so the incentive for profit here is not to create new jobs. It's to get that money rolled over as fast as they can. So you're going to go in lower risk companies to get that money back. Members, we could do much better. Some people have suggested if you're going to use $75 million, in other states they have talked about, just give $1 million to 75 different businesses just by a raffle, and you're going to do much better. Members, it's flawed. It's not even like the angel investment credit. This system is flawed, and look at the literature. And, you know, every state, the proposers, they come in with a little different plan, but it's all the same. The incentive, as I mentioned, like a traditional venture capitalist, is not for profit of the business, so it's high growth and you sell it for profit. The incentive is just to roll over those dollars and decertify, and then you keep it. You don't care what the business does. Where the traditional venture capitalist has skin in the game, and they're right there, and that's the only way they make the profit. So, now the state, if there are profits, we get 10%. So I do get 10% back according to the bill. So here it is. The state, I'm going to lose, as a taxpayer, I'm going to lose all of the principal. I'm going to lose 90% of the profits. And 50% that I give out will never go to these businesses. They're put in safe havens to make sure they pay back the insurance company so they get their money back. It is a bad deal from all fronts. And I've got a lot more here, but I think just understanding how that works, and that is a system set up in this bill, because it's very identical to the bill we saw a couple years ago. And I've looked, the results of these are, in fact, Wisconsin, I think they eliminated their program, I think in 06, and someone can correct me, I'm trying to get the reading on that, because they're trying to reinstate it in 2011, huge debate in Wisconsin. And I know that's one of the states here. And even when Wisconsin had it, in comparison to the state of Minnesota, Research showed that actually what they had wasn't any better than what Minnesota was doing. In fact, Minnesota was doing better even during that time frame. So I don't know if I describe the way this works typically and the way it's set up in the bill, but that's the way they typically have been set up in states, and there is absolutely no incentive to create new jobs. And in fact, the only thing I see in the bill where they mention jobs is that we just have to report jobs. And I can give you examples in other states where they put money into businesses that are well established, and they're quick buybacks, and they're not your typical early starter where you can get high growth and high employment out of. So I guess I'll...
Mr. Cassidy, you know, you got a chance with Mark Ford here. Or is it Mark Ford? Should we put you down as a no? Any response, Mr. Cassidy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, just to answer a few of your questions. First and foremost, a lot of the studies you cite are from competing economic development models. There are other economic development models out there that others are promoting around state capitals right now that compete with us, and they've been very critical of it, as we've been critical of them as well. Second, there's competition for scarce state dollars. We know that. We understand that. And typically when this model comes under attack, it's in the second or third year where people go, where are the jobs, and why haven't we, aren't we generating the revenue quickly? And we say, listen, this takes time to get jobs in the pipeline to get going. That's what happened in Colorado. And by the way, Colorado was years ago. This model is dramatically different than Colorado. Third, I will say this program has never been repealed. It's been under attack a number of times by competitors and by state lawmakers who have different priorities, but it has never been repealed. Washington, D.C., in fact, it was under attack after the first year, and it did have $22 million in the pipeline, and of course it wasn't generating, you know, hundreds and hundreds of jobs. But what did the city council do in Washington, D.C.? They re-endorsed the program, and they re-upped. Second, I will say that the numbers that we report come from two places, university research studies, and second, audited financials and audited reports that are submitted to state regulators. Finally, I will point out that venture capitalists aren't doing these deals. These are $100,000, $200,000, up to $2 million deals that VCs aren't touching right now. That's the problem that we're trying to get to. You have to incent somebody to make those investments. VCs aren't doing them. One more point is the idea that 50% or 55% or 60% of the dollars are only invested out of the $75 million or $100 million, whatever we're going to target right now. 100% of the capital has to be invested before you take distributions out of this program. That is in the bill. It's clearly written in the bill. And if we need to make it more clear, we will.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Mark, or Representative Downey, then.
If I could. I struggle even to know how to respond to the scenario that Representative Marquardt presented, because I don't think it has anything to do with what is actually happening out in the marketplace and what this bill is intended to incentivize. Just real briefly to Mr. Cassidy's last point, you can find on page 7, line 7, the schedule by which the business investment companies have to have deployed their capital over a period of 6 years. And then you can also, on page 8, line 9, see that a business investment company can't invest more than 15% of its designated capital in any one venture. So this scenario that Representative Marquardt tried to paint, where people would just throw their money in something and turn it over, it's just not possible under the terms of this. And I want to get back to what actually really happens and what this bill is intended to do. In the early stage investment world, there are venture capitalists and there are individuals who pool together their funds and put together a fund and a program where they are going to go out and invest in a whole series of companies. And the reason they do a whole series of companies is it manages their risk. The more companies you have, the lower your risk, you know, just by virtue of the fact that you've spread it out, just like you do with your own personal investments. And so venture capitalists are no longer playing in this space right now, just by virtue of the nature of the investment market. And so this incentive is a way for insurance companies who have a lot of investable reserves to have an incentive to pool their money with other investors in an investment company to invest in other businesses. That is how this works. And so this scenario that Representative Marquardt painted of people grabbing the money and then putting it in a company and then turning it just fundamentally doesn't understand how these investments work. And the only way you can turn a company and actually sell it is if it has the potential to, in the future, create more value than the cost. I know some people don't like profit here, but profit in the marketplace is an indication where the value of what you're doing is greater than what it costs. That is a good thing. And you're never going to be able to flip a company. You're never going to turn anything private until you have done strategically what you need to do to turn that company into something that has sustainable value and profit-making potential. And so this perspective that, gee, the state is slamming $75 million out there just is not accurate at all. And with regard to the jobs claims, this points out one of the fundamental flaws of all the jobs claims that you hear on bonding bills and everything else. If you go out and spend $75 million and you pay a person $75,000 a year, guess what? You've created 1,000 jobs for 1 year, and that's it. But when you strategically invest $75 million, you may not create 1,000 jobs, but you will create fewer jobs that exist in perpetuity. Why? Because you've satisfied a need in the marketplace. You've actually created a company that has enduring customer demand and the need for employees and investment and strategic participation with partners that creates long-term lasting value in the economy. And so when you hear about all these jobs claims for a bonding bill, guess what? Those aren't FTE equivalents over a 10-year period like the kinds of jobs that you create here. Those are one-term contracts. They might last 3 months, they might last a year, and they're gone. And so, yeah, you don't see these wild jobs claims estimates like you do on a bonding bill from the president or the governor. This is what it takes to actually create a lasting job. And so, yeah, you don't get the number of jobs that you might by spending a bunch of money in a bonding bill, but what you get is you get long-term employment, not a short-term contract. So, members, we've just got to think a little more clearly about this and not get taken in by some of this rhetoric and this perspective that every time the state spends a buck that it's got to create a job. We're just incentivizing private sector investment.
Okay, Rips and Marquardt, if you be a bit brief. Because
you bet. I will. And thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Downey would not be here if they didn't need the state's $75 million. Otherwise, they'd let a traditional venture capital model work. The key is the $75 million from the state. And nowhere did I hear from Mr. Cassidy or Representative Downey anything about that I'm wrong on where the incentives are. I didn't hear anyone say I was wrong on, in fact, the incentive is not in creating new jobs. It's to just decertify the money as quickly as you can. And yes, they have to do 100%. That's why you have to turn it over and you have to make it quick. 50% has to be decertified within 3 years. So that means that first $37 that Representative Conan puts in have to come back in the first 3 years. That's not a long-term equity, skin in the game type of situation. And I think Wisconsin, and I might be wrong, did eliminate this in 2011. So I think that's something, Mr. Cassidy, we need to check on. But I couldn't tell for sure, but I know they were talking about there's a big debate. So I think in 2011 in Wisconsin, in fact, they might have did away with the program, but I don't know that for sure, but I know there's a lot of debate. So members, again, the risk and the funding is with the Minnesota taxpayer. With almost no assurance and nothing in this bill showing that any new jobs will be created.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Downey, I appreciate the fact that you brought an idea forward. You're thinking. I mean, do we think that jobs just happen miraculously? They don't. They take a lot of work. And most of them put in many years having a day job to pay for their living while they work in the evenings or nights to get things going. And to have a return on your investment, I thought was a good idea. Why are we slamming people who actually try to have a return on investment? Look at your stock accounts and everything else. I think we all like to see a little return on our investment. And so I want to commend you for thinking and these processes and doing it with other states. It is too bad that we cannot have a better business climate so that some of these special programs are making the effort to do as they are. But Representative Downey, once again, I've heard about the risk and some of these issues, and so How is the dynamic in a long-term basis in regards to jobs that you see this will do rather than just the temporary jobs?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the intention here is not to have $75 million flow out of the state and thus pay somebody to work for a limited period of time. The intention of that $75 million tax credit is an incentive for insurance companies to invest their reserves in a slightly higher risk way and increase their portfolio of early stage investment, which right now is not occurring. And so the need that this fills, or the way this quote unquote creates jobs, is simply by making a more attractive investment community for, again, in this case, one particular set of investors with capital to invest. And I'd go back and point out to members that the governor made a big deal out of putting $100 million of the state's cash reserves into the community bankers. I happen to have some connections with the community banks, and I think every single one of them will tell you they don't need $100 million in cash, as though somehow if they had more deposits, they'd be loaning money. What they're doing with that $100 million is investing it in the overnight markets to make a little tiny sliver of a point on something. What they need is good investable deals that fit their risk profile, and they are very risk averse right now. And so if we can kind of light up and enliven and incentivize early stage investment in other areas where the traditional banking and even the traditional venture capital community isn't doing it, that is what this program is intended to do. So anybody who thinks that we're writing a check for $75 million and we better get some jobs out of it, that's not what's happening. It's an incentive to the marketplace to be more active in a place where it's not very active right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And exactly, Representative Downey, this is a sustainable effort. This is not just a one-time effort. It is a sustainable effort. And I have yet to see anybody put money somewhere where they didn't have the hope of a return. Our hope is additional jobs and a return to the state by the additional income taxes, individual income tax, property taxes, a variety of other ways that the state of Minnesota benefits from this kind of a program. But the most important thing is that you need people who are successful, who are able to generate that, who are able to have a return on that. We don't fund failures. We fund success because they usually have learned how to do it and can do it again and again and again. And that kind of sustainable activity, long-term good quality jobs, is exactly what Minnesota needs. And I just want to thank you for bringing an idea forward. Thank you.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, in your beginning part when you were talking about this bill, as I heard you talk about the bill, it just seemed to me that the bill would give tax credits to a few select people. And to me, that feels like the government picking winners and losers, and it doesn't seem like a very conservative principle. So I was surprised to hear that you were bringing this proposal forward. And another thing you said when you were introducing this CAPCO part of the bill is that these are businesses that aren't quite bankable. And I just thought, why would we want to risk the taxpayers' money if a bank wouldn't risk their money on these businesses that aren't quite bankable?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman, you raise really good questions, and I think that is the essence of the debate we should have, and not this other confusion about how the state's investing. You know, you could argue that the $75 million should go into the angel investment credit program, right? That's a very high-risk, extremely early-stage pool of companies that just aren't getting investment in Minnesota because of the tax climate here. You could argue that this should go in corporate tax relief in a more targeted way. You could argue that this should go to personal income tax relief for LLPs and pass-through entities. You could argue a lot of different things. It is a program. It has proven that it does work in other states. It does go after one place in the economy where there are a lot of investable reserves and an appetite in investing if the risk profile were just a little bit less. So you're exactly right. This is a targeted tax credit that is designed to try to increase investment in smaller early stage companies that right now have a risk profile that the traditional investment markets just aren't going to go for. So, I mean, it's a great debate and a great question. It's a program that I think will work and that will get right at these companies that are struggling to find capital at a critical time when they're just about ready to grow and can't find the money right now.
Councilperson Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that as members of the legislature, we have kind of a fiduciary responsibility to the taxpayers to take good care of their money. And if a bank executive looks at a business investment in this area and says it's not a good risk for my depositors, then I don't know why we as legislators would say it's a good risk for the taxpayers' dollars.
Thank you, Representative Hartman. Representative Anderson. Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to offer that maybe we should think in terms of the risk being 100% carried by the taxpayer. I sure, as an econ teacher, would love to sit down with people and talk about the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 and what that has become. So that was just I'd just like to offer that.
I'm sure we'd find it fascinating. Thank you, Representative Bills. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, it's amazing to me that we're talking about $75 million, which, you know, in many committees in this legislature, you know, we can fight like cats and dogs over a figure significantly less, but it's into the future. It's 4 years out that we pay the bill, even though we're going to give the money and get it activated, you know, earlier than that in some other ways. But I kept hearing these words, not quite bankable, helping businesses through the valley of death. It's still high risk. The venture capitalists won't do these now. The risk profile is such that traditional investment markets won't go for these. And, you know, to qualify as a venture capitalist, my understanding is you have to have at least $1 million to cover your own sort of expenses of life, you know, so you're not going to go on our public programs. So we've got people who have at least $1 million, and many of them many, many more. And, you know, they've heard about this nice idea, this neat guy or woman who's a friend of a friend, and they think it's got real potential, but, you know, it's kind of, you're not sure, does this person really have a good idea? Do they really know what they're doing? Is the market ready for them? You know, and they've gotten past the point of borrowing, you know, the easy $500 from their brother and brother-in-law and $1,000 from their friend that they graduated from college at, and they've gotten maybe even past a couple hundred thousand from a nice network that most of us don't have. And now they're going to the people that they don't have as close a relationship with, the people who have $1 million. And even those people don't think it's a good idea. And yet we as a state are supposed to incent them through a convoluted arrangement that involves insurance companies and investment managers and a lot of people making money along the way to do what their instincts and their expertise in financial analysis says they shouldn't do. It's just too risky. And we're supposed to do it based on the idea that somewhere, sometimes, some of these actually might work into a company that becomes a long-term success. And I don't think we should be betting our future dollars on that when we haven't even brought forward to this committee a proposal to pay back our school districts who are right now borrowing money from those same people who might be on the board of directors of banks that aren't going to touch this. We haven't done that. And it seems to me like that's job number one. And I still don't understand why it's a role of government to incent millionaires to do things that their instincts tell them it's not in their best interests. And I want to contrast that with, you know, we're always told the best jobs and the most jobs are created by small businesses. And a story that played out in the last year in my community, some of you know my main district, Central Avenue, is kind of the hotbed of international gourmet, wonderful food. And we have restaurants that have Ecuadorian and Guatemalan and Mexican and Asian and Middle Eastern and Moroccan and Vietnamese. And we have almost everything on the world there. So if you want to see the world and you can't afford a ticket, you can come to Northeast and get at least a little authentic flavor of it. And so this young family had an idea that, you know, there isn't any Indian restaurants in this particular area. They saw a place that there was something missing. You came to Northeast to see the world, but there's no Indian food. And so they opened up, went through all the processes. It's fairly expensive to get the kitchen certified and all this stuff. And they opened up an Indian restaurant. And I've eaten there several times, and it was really good food. But you know what? They're undercapitalized. And part of it was because the owner, nice family business, the owner had worked for over 20 years for one of our major employers, a name that many of us would recognize and know, and he was laid off. And it was for 2.5 years he tried to find an engineering job, but he learned that at 47 years of age he was too old, and that the market, job market, wasn't going to open it up for him. But his wife was a really good cook. They both had some kind of business background, and so they were going to fulfill her dream of having this Indian restaurant. And, you know, it was really good, but they're undercapitalized, and it's now shuttered. And I can't help but thinking, you know, that was a better bet on a street that's got a lot of energy and a lot of people investing their hard-earned cash in every, you know, buying lunch and dinner. That was a better bet than what we're asked to back up on these millionaires with somebody else's idea. And I don't see where, if we're going to stimulate the economy, helping stimulate millionaires to invest in ideas is what we ought to do. And I think our number one job, if we've got $75 million in the future we want to commit, it ought to be to you know, helping our small businesses, paying back the schools, doing some more serious sort of work. And so I'd really like to understand why when it's this risky, it's the state's obligation to step up and do some incenting.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Loeffler, a couple of things. First of all, you mentioned the capitalization requirements of the small business investment companies and their expertise, and that's on page 4, subdivision 2. It talks about the certification process, and they have to have $500,000 in other capital, and they have to have at least two principals who are money manager experience. So this is not intended to have individuals with no experience step up and somehow become small business investment companies. And then with regard to your broader point, and this is the same one that Representative Fortman raised, and it's a great question, and it's good discussion. You know, the reality is, in the investment realm, in that investment continuum, you have places where there are early stage, higher risk opportunities, and people historically have been willing to participate in those areas. And part of the way you manage your risk is you build a portfolio of companies and you make some bets on what's going to win, and one fund does really great and one fund does average, maybe one fund does crummy and then another fund does really great. But even those kinds of funds are not, that activity just isn't happening in Minnesota anymore. And so when you get further up the continuum and you've got companies that are already well capitalized and they have the profits and they have the revenue streams in the markets that they can demonstrate, the banks are going to be there for them. They'd love to be there for them. But this area of our economy has really suffered in the recent past, and so that's why this program is targeted at them. And the reality is, If we don't do these kinds of things, and I'd rather not do them. I'd rather just, you know, cut our rates and turn Minnesota into an investment hotbed. But these places are going to sell. They're going to go under. They're going to move to South Dakota. I know a guy who had to sell his med tech business to a film company in Japan because they wanted the technology. He couldn't find the capital to actually keep it going. And so, you know, you can argue this is the wrong place for us to be offering tax credits. That's a great discussion. I think it's worth it. We've re-energized the early stage angel part of the continuum, and I think we have a chance with something like this to take it down the next kind of piece of the continuum and give small businesses that fit this category a new opportunity to find some folks that are willing to make some higher risk investments.
Hey, members, stay tuned to your email. You'll see some property tax, some bills that will be referred over to the property tax division, so just stay tuned for those. Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just conclude by saying, you know, words count, and the word I kept hearing was bet, you know, a bet on this, and that's why you diversify, and it's, you know, so you kind of hedge your bets, and I'm just not willing to go there with so little opportunity to see that it's really going to result in anything that is a guarantee and or a responsibility of us as state legislators. I think there's many more models that are much more effective that may not benefit the millionaires who are looking for someone to help hedge their bet, but that I think have demonstrated value within our community, and I hope that we'll look seriously at those.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, as you recall, I carried the Angel bill, and that included in it some clawback provisions. I think, you know, bipartisanly, we may find some of these proposals contentious, but bipartisanly, historically, we've called for transparency and accountability for the expenditure of public funds. And I'm not finding any accountability language in your CAPCO provisions around the creation of jobs. And I'm wondering if you could point to me in the legislation where there's the accountability for creation of jobs here in Minnesota through the investment of the $75 million.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, boy, I'm not remembering the clawbacks on job creation in the Angel Investment Tax Credit Bill. I do know that we required the department to produce a report for us, which we saw kind of an first iteration of here today. I would maybe point out two things. The first is the amendment that we added, I think, is much stronger than the Angel Bill in terms of requiring that the tax credit not be paid until and unless the economic impact of the investment exceeds the cost of the tax credit. So to this comment that the state of Minnesota is betting with its funds, that's not what we're doing. We're trying to provide a tax credit incentive so that others who do this for a living might be more inclined to do it. They're the ones that make the investments. They're the ones that make the bets, not the state of Minnesota. So anyway, I'm not sure, Representative Dabney, if that answers your question. I'd have to take a look at the bill. I thought we had some of the similar reporting requirements back to the legislature in the CAPCO bill. If we don't, I think it would be a good add to make sure that the same report requirements from Deed are in place for the small business investment companies as well as for the Angel tax credit. And I would just point out again, the Angel environment is much higher risk than the space that we're trying to fit with the small business investment company credit.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm taking that there is not actually any accountability language for job creation in the CAPCO language, that there's no clawback provision for these companies if they don't create any jobs.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's the same clawback language for job creation in this bill that there was in the Angel investment bill that you carried and that we all voted on.
Representative Downey? Or excuse me, Representative Dabney?
We're often confused, Mr. Chair. I guess my last comment is I'd like Representative Downey of today to meet Representative Downey of last week, because last week you were arguing that tax expenditures are simply allowing people to keep their money and operate as they wish freely. And this week you're arguing that a tax expenditure actually incents, guides, and directs behavior. And that was exactly part of my point last week, that tax expenditures are about responding to special interest groups and what they want. And here's $75 million in special interest group money to guide, direct, and incent behaviors that we as the legislature think is the right thing. And I guess, I'd encourage Representative Downey today to meet Representative Downey last week and have a conversation with each other.
Mr. Downey? I don't think I've ever said that we're spending money here. In fact, I think the whole argument has been that we're not spending money here. We are allowing private sector investors to do something with their investments that they might not do if they didn't have this tax credit as an incentive. And I think I was pretty clear in my presentation last week that evaluating all of these credits is a worthy policy discussion. And so I don't think I've ever argued that they aren't directing an incentive or trying to create or modify behavior in the market. That's a legitimate discussion. But equating spending with credits that allow people to hold on to their money and do different things is an entirely different question. And I suggest that the term spending is an inaccurate one, even for this credit.
Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Downey.
Representative Gottwald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've enjoyed listening to this debate, as I have many here on the Tax Committee, about what we do with $75 million under our control. we can sink it into more government programs, more people on government programs, more people under dependency and on need. But I think it's a pretty reasonable proposal, and Representative Downey, I want to give you credit for bringing it forward, to use a tax credit to allow investors to keep some of their money to sink into creating jobs. You know, Representative Marquardt, you can go through your list and say it only created this many or that many. Representative Loeffler, it was short of sneering about million-dollar people, you know, all these million dollar. I would love to have more million-dollar people in our state spending their money on ventures that create sustainable long-term employment. People who can pay for their groceries and their health care costs, who can pay taxes, who can continue contributing to our society instead of having to go on public programs because we don't create sustainable jobs. Or taking the same $75 million to do a bunch of bonding proposals, 10% of which go at to additional prevailing wage and don't create a single new job, and don't create lasting jobs. They're project specific. So it really is a question of where do we put our resources as a state? Do we put it towards helping the private sector succeed, which, by the way, doesn't mean that fat cats get rich. It means that people get jobs. It means that people get jobs so they can go and pay their bills and be contributing parts of society and not have to depend on government. That's a very noble, legitimate cause. I think what Representative Downey brought to the table here could be a helpful part of that. But I am really tired of hearing about, well, these million-dollar people who go to their friends and their neighbors who have $1,000 to chip in here and there. Representative Loeffler, you've probably never worked in economic development. I have, both at a city level and at a local level. And I can tell you that it is difficult trying to make ends meet as businesses creating jobs in this society. And that when you're trying in competition, not only with other states and with other communities, but on a global level, to help businesses succeed so they can create sustainable, permanent jobs. That's our goal here. And to sneer at people who might have some money to invest, I mean, it shocks me. It shocks me that we take that tone with these people. You know, that's where we get this whole Occupy Wall Street movement. You know, I want to see those people, and especially if the environment is not such that they feel they can invest that money at this point, I want to encourage them to do it. I want to do that in every way possible because every job they create, every dollar that they invest is going to turn several times that investment for the state of Minnesota in jobs, in taxes, in additional investment. I mean, that is the lifeblood of our economy. The goose that lays Minnesota's golden eggs are the employers. If you don't have investors willing to invest in employers, you don't get the golden eggs. I mean, that's the reality here, folks. So we can question whether or not Representative Downey's bill gets at that sufficiently or creates enough of the golden eggs, as Representative Marquardt allocated. But let's stop castigating and using terminology that suggests that people who have money to invest are somehow fat, wealthy, rich cats who aren't doing their fair share. I get tired of it.
This is what we're going to do. We have 2 minutes, but since the name of Representative Loeffler was invoked and Marquardt, I think we'll let Representative Loeffler wrap it up here, and then we will adjourn. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't mean to sneer at anyone who's pursuing their dreams, whether they're very poor or they happen to be blessed with wealth. But I can say I have known people who have had incredible wealth and have lost it because they have had the courage to pursue their dreams and invited other people in to share in the pursuit of their dreams, and who have, in the end, ended up in bankruptcy. And we know that going into business is incredibly risky. And I'm not disagreeing with anyone having that opportunity to do that, and even becoming dependent on public assistance when their dreams crash. That's okay. That's what it's for. That's why we have a safety net, so people can pick themselves up and dust themselves off and move on to contribute in our economy and go work for someone else. But I do think we do have a serious, serious obligation to say with our limited resources, what are we going to use $75 million to do, and who is most worthy of our investment of public funds? And I just don't think this is the route to developing the jobs that I think a lot of people are hoping for. for us to develop.
Thank you, Representative Lafleur. And with that, we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you, committee members and staff, for your work today. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.